evening, I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
You're watching Consider This. Today on the show, we have Dr. Alexander Gerlach, who is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. And he's also a columnist at DW. He's got a column called Gerlach Global, which touches on the future of democracy and the liberal world order, which is precisely what we're going to be discussing today. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. So, you know, we're going to be celebrating the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall this Saturday. And I wanted to talk to you about the Germany you grew up in and the Germany of today. So talk to us a bit about how Germany has changed and the assumptions that you once grew up with are now being challenged.
Yeah, thank you. I was 13 years old when the wall came down, literally like until very, like, let's say the summer of the year. Nobody would have thought it and deemed it possible the wall ever to come down. So we were like literally like surprised when we saw how the people like took the streets like in the weeks before the wall came down, and how it was literally like effectively with one stroke of a pen or like one sentence of this one functionary of the Communist Party was just like opened for all Germans. It was like a very joyous night. In result, it meant to me, and I realized this years later in my work as a journalist, actually, I had a colleague who was 10 years younger than me, and he wrote a self-description, and he said he grew up, he became politically aware in the time between 9/11 and the Lehman Brothers collapse of the bank, and I thought, wait a minute. So I became politically aware after the fall of the Berlin Wall. How positive this time was. You know, like when I was a child, you could not go like very far east from where I'm from. There was like the Iron Curtain that divided Europe. Mm. And my like adolescence and then me being a young man and a student, actually the world was free and was open. And that basically shaped my idea of the world.
Right. You know, one of the most recent headlines we had coming out of Germany was the city council of Dresden, you know, declared a Nazi crisis, you know, along like in analogous to a sort of ecological crisis. And I know there's got complexities of that story, but it sort of signals a Germany where there's a resurgent right wing and part of the European story. I mean, does that surprise you that, and coming from what is formerly the East Germany?
So what happened after the end of the Second World War, so the eastern sector was taken by the Russians and the other three were the other like allies, France, Britain and the United States. And that in the West, what became Western Germany, they started a denazification. And this was also like a hard endeavor. It took like one generation in the 68ers, as we called them, you know, the time when this global like movement broke. And then these children would ask their parents, Dad, what did you do in the war? So even in Western Germany, it took a long time until denazification took a strong hold. Having said that, in the eastern part, however, where the Russians took over, did not deploy into democracy, so there was like the next dictatorship moving in. And so what they did was they just declared Nazidom over without like having like a public sort of like movement and like, you know, as we had in Western Germany, which leads in effect to that Nazis were never a Nazidom, or the thoughts of the ideologies of the Nazis was never defeated. So after the wall came down in 1989 and 1990, we see like reports about like how students in school, in high school back then, debated like, I mean, but Nazi thoughts have been around forever. They were just like covered up under the communist era and the communist dictatorship. And now you see like for the new right-wing party, which we unfortunately have, in Western Germany there's like 10% of people rooting for them, but in Eastern Germany it's up to 30. So you clearly see there's a difference, because in Eastern Germany there was never like a period where they like denazificated.
Okay. You know, one of the things that you suggest is that ideas never die. Mm. And even bad ideas remain with us, right? And so the question of whether democracies can remain true to their core while keeping hold of this, like an expression that you've used in the past, you know, how do the tolerant deal with the intolerant? Can you unpack that for us?
I mean, yeah, so like when we talk about liberal democracy, literally we mean like the iteration of democracy we have nowadays. And that entails a few things. When we look like far back into history, like in the antiquities, only the man, the father of the family, could go and engage in politics. Until 100 years ago, women were not allowed to vote. So now nowadays, our iteration of democracy now says us basically there is not such a thing as the dominion of a majority over a minority. If you win an election this time, maybe next time another party wins, or even you as a voter, you may change affiliation. So like it's about the society as a whole, and the society has majorities and minorities, but they all have to somehow like get along with one another. And that's basically what liberal democracy means. So, and there is no such thing as a non-liberal democracy nowadays, because we don't want to go back to the times where women had no suffrage, right? So that's actually the setup of democracy. And nowadays you find these, like, they call themselves illiberals, and what they mean is like, we define who the majority is, and the majority rules over the minorities, and period. And that's not what we have deployed after the horrors of the Second World War and the Shoah.
Right. So then why are these, you know, ideas that never die, why are these ideas seeing emergence once again? 30% in East Germany, you said.
It's also like a global phenomenon. Like, look, I'm not shying away from the German question, but I give a broader concept here. Like in America, when Barack Obama was elected president, he was highlighting that he is of Kenyan descent, and he has relatives all over the planet, and he made and labeled this an American story. And it's actually true. It's a very cosmopolitan one, and shows you that you are connected to other parts of the world. Whereas when Donald Trump came about, he's never getting tired to say he's a nationalist. And what he means by that is, in American terms, he's an isolationist. So there is, like, I'm saying this, neither Donald Trump invented this idea, nor did Barack Obama invent this idea. The idea and the struggle to whether or not the United States are a cosmopolitan nation or a white nation for white people is around since the foundation of the nation. Mm. And so it's like the Germans have always had like the question, are we Western? Are we like looking towards the East? So, and this is why they call it the German Sonderweg, the particular way of the Germans. And nowadays you find in Germany lots of people like leaning towards the United States, and you find also people leaning towards Russia, because Germany is geographically like positioned in the middle of Europe.
Yeah.
However, having said that, specifically because of the Nazi past, I believe like democratic ideas have set root very quickly in Germany, and the German society has become rather liberal over the course of the last 70 years because they did not want to see history repeating itself.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation on the liberal world order in just a couple of minutes right here on Consider This. Make sure you stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, with me Sharad Kutin, and we're chatting to Dr. Alex Gerlach about the world order, the liberal world order. I want to pick up on something that you said just before the break, and to kind of put it into context of what's happening around the world. We're seeing a spate of protests around the world. Talk to me a little bit about how perhaps the democracy, democracy model that we know of, perhaps, you know, the American model of democracy may no longer be relevant in today's age.
After the Second World War, in the Pacifics and in Western Europe, the United States deployed like a model, if you will, that was like, let's not talk about politics first. Let's just try to build something together economically. Mm-hmm. And that's happened in the Pacifics and Western Europe. And then the so-called economic miracle took off in Germany. And what happened in that time was like, if you went to school, if you worked hard, you could just had a better living and a better living. And social inequalities, when they arose, they were also like then, some would say covered up or paid or whatever by social welfare. And this happened through indebting. And nowadays we live in a world where natural resources shrink, where we don't have interest rates anymore as we used to be. So this whole model that's based on growth will be coming to an end, and we all know it. And now also we see like the scarcity, the alleged or the real scarcity in goods kicking in. And this is why people cannot be like, or are not as keen as they used to be a few decades ago to also like help others. Being like cosmopolitans in the true sense of the word, it meant like we are engaged with the whole human family. Sure. And now we realize people retreat to kinship and family, and this is due to the crisis of the economic model.
What about the European story? We know Germany is deeply embedded in the cornerstone of the European ideal of a federated Europe. Where is that going? Perhaps not a Scandinavian model or welfarism, but some sort of social democratic compact that is, as you say, underpin the democratic experiment in Europe. Is that something that's still worth saving?
Well, I feel that's actually, if you look on the global map, that's what makes Europe special, that it found a middle ground of like capitalism and communism and socialism, if you will, that like that we in Europe, we acknowledge the market, but the market can never be unhinged. So in that sense, we are a little closer to the Chinese, even where they have like they invest into infrastructure. Europeans would always invest into infrastructure and say this is kind of a common good. Yeah. Whereas in the United States, when you say like, oh, we invest in that, people say, well, that's socialism. So I feel that the European model actually in today's world has the most bandwidth, if you will, to cope with these developments nowadays.
Well, I want to kind of talk about the G0 world, right? Where there's that kind of a vacuum of political and economic leadership from the world's superpowers, once with the world's superpowers. I mean, all these, decision makers are so fixated on addressing some of the domestic crises that no one is actually taking leadership for the global leadership. And I think that could come with an array of consequences in the midterm and the long term. Talk to me about where you see Europe in this, specifically Germany. Is there a position for Europe to be leading the world when it comes to making these decisions?
So, I mean, literally, I mean, I totally agree with your analysis, and Germany as an export nation is like very much focused on this aspect. So when it comes to talking to foreign powers, like let's say the People's Republic of China, it will always be like the economic interest first. Having said that, however, and I feel also the Germans, because they are as powerful as they are nowadays, they are one of the few nations that then actually also can say something about the right. human rights issues. So when former head of state Joachim Gauck went to China and saw President Xi Jinping, they had like 90 minutes FaceTime, and I'm sure he brought up some human rights issues. So this is like a good example nowadays where soft power and hard power, if you will, go hand in hand, because the United States have obviously, like under Donald Trump, retrieved from this sort of soft power approach, and this is why we see a vacuum nowadays, and China has been eager trying to fill it.
What about the US? Where does the US sit? I mean, you've spent time in the US in the last few years. Where do you see America in this G0 world?
It's literally astonishing. Like 25 years ago, Samuel Huntington wrote this book about the clash of civilizations, and he predicted that the world will be like not be bipolar anymore, will have like lots of centers of gravity, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the Western world, in his idea, was like one of many, but still led by the United States of America. And he would be looping in his grave. He would be seeing like what the heck's going on nowadays. So literally, what we perceive as the Western world is like in a deep crisis because the United States has given up on its leadership.
So, coming back to Europe and some of the debacles we see, Brexit, the big issue around Brexit is a failure of Europe to respond, we are told, to the needs of Britons, right? Their aspirations or their suspicion about Brussels and so on and so forth. We also see it in Italy and so on and so forth. Do you think that Europe has kind of turned the corner on that? Or is that something that's going to stay with Europe for a long time? And intellectuals like yourself, I mean, where do you stand in the discussions or where Europe should be or aspire to be?
The thing is, like, globalization has brought upon us like a new, like, global middle class, if you will, but at the same time it has also like delivered like a new lower class, and this is like very difficult to disentangle. You see like rising GDPs, but this is like Chile, for instance, outside of Europe, but still, but that's due to automatization leads to more efficiency and more productivity. So if you look at the GDP, you say, oh, everything is great, but then if you look, assuming that means people have more money in their pockets, which they don't. Even in Germany, like let's say the workforce is about 40 million people, so 9 million people work in the low income sector. Mm. So literally they serve in a coffee shop like where they make like $7.50 an hour, like a coffee, like like a super fancy coffee for the same money. They work for an hour, and then they see like people like just in the hundreds a day who can spend this money they make in 1 hour. Francis Fukuyama, in his recent book on identity, called this like the feeling of indignation. Mm. So when people like go and work and they do not make enough to meet ends, that creates like this feeling of like I do not belong, I cannot participate. And if you are like a father, mother and two children, and visiting the cinema costs you $100, then clearly you feel like disentangled, and that is a crisis of democracy, because democracy lives by the promise that people can participate in the public sphere.
What about the identity of Europe as a as a coming together of Christian nations. And I know in Germany there is an organization called Pegida, which is anti-Muslim. But does that go to a deeper problem about how Europeans identify themselves, kind of on the surface, secular, but actually with deeply held notions about them being Christians?
So there's been last year, there has been a survey by the Pew Institute in DC, and that was like the results were rather astonishing. So they asked about Christian affiliation across Europe. So 90% of the surveyed answered they are baptized. So they remember they at some point they were made Christians, obviously. So that 90%, that means like by numbers, this is still like a Christian continent, if you wanna call it like that. 70% said they would, Christian values, whatever that means, matter in their life. 20% out of them only go to church every week. So clearly religion had, in like in many other parts of the world, has a public dimension. It also has a political dimension. So Christianity is still one of the pillars of today's Europe, at least in the assumptions of its populace. So this is why when you are an immigrant from a Muslim nation, for instance, that raises to many like some suspicions about loyalty and about belonging. Also like on the other hand by the people who come to our countries. However, I'd also say the notion is like that religion, but if religion matters, it's also the question, like, it's not about the past, but about the future and the present. So in the refugee crisis, there were lots of debates about what does it mean actually to be a Christian continent? What do we have to help the refugees and to what extent? So just to hold it like the Pegida people, they are called patriotic Europeans to save Europe from Islamization. And literally they take off like in a part of Germany, which used to be like in the communist part of Germany, like in Dresden, as you said. And there's the percentage of Christians in that city is 10%. And you see like in many parts of Europe, like people who have never seen a foreigner, who have never seen a Muslim, are the most against them. So like liberal values, as in terms of cosmopolitan values, or democratic values as in terms of tolerance, they are very much upheld like in metropolis areas. And if you look into, also that Fukuyama wrote this in his book, like if you look for a common denominator in the Brexit vote and the vote for Donald Trump, it's not socioeconomic, it's not age, it's not gender, it's the population density. So as less populated the region is, as more inclined people are to buy in all these us versus them narratives.
Okay, so what can we learn from that? I mean, using that premise, what can we learn about the spread of these ideas?
So in Europe, and we spoke about religion now, when human rights came about in the 16th century, the notion of that, it was about religious toleration. So, and I feel this is still very, very high up there, and when Europeans talk about it, but there's also like there's iterations in our understanding of human rights. And now, coming back to what we said about the global economic crisis, there is also like human rights for fresh air, clean water and all this. And that also in the end means like a fair and just economic system. And this is what we have to learn, I believe. This is also an example that Europe can give to the world, like how we iterate our idea and notion of human rights.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation in just a couple of minutes. Make sure you stay tuned to Consider This. Welcome back to Consider This. Melissa and Sharad chatting to Dr. Alex Gerlach. He also has is the editor-in-chief of an online magazine on technology, AI and ethics called The Human Condition. Yes, Sharad?
Yeah, so you've been in media. You've actually been a journalist, apart from all your many academic qualifications. I just want to ask you a practical point of view. As journalists, we struggle to make sense of the world for our readers, for our viewers, right? But we come with different values. How has the media, as you see it, the public sphere more generally, the media in it, played a role? I mean, have we made things worse? Have we failed in some sense to make sense of the world for our viewers and therefore have not helped mitigate the worst tendencies, you know? We've gone for the devils rather than the angels in our nature.
So almost 50 years ago, Alvin Toffler wrote a book, it was called The Future Shock. And I sum it up for you, it's one sentence, it's easy. He said, like, at some point, progress is so fast that even elites in societies cannot comprehend it. So if you believe that that media is like, you know, the marketplace, the sphere, the public sphere in which all ideas are debated, and therefore also belonging like a little bit what you would call to elites or to, yeah, the elites in society. I feel so many things have happened in the last 10, 15 years, also to our industry, if you will, by the internet and like struggling with our business models, that we are also not capable of explaining as we used to, because the world has gotten more complex. And this is, like, if you look into the radical movements we have been talking about, it's not only people that are deprived socioeconomically who vote for Donald Trump or for Brexit, it's also like people from the former elite who want to make sense of the world. So I wouldn't say necessarily we made the problem bigger, but we were definitely not immune to it.
I do want to know also, I mean, the idea that at the moment, you know, social media has amplified everything, every single idea from around the world. You can find someone out there who agrees or disagree with you. And with your online magazine called The Human Condition, I find that fascinating, how we as humans are responding to this, because the way we consume information has changed drastically. And what that has led to has been this crisis of trust within not just the media, but also each other, because of the information that's out there. Could you help unpack that a little bit for us?
Maybe. I mean, I started off in German television in Mainz. That's the city where my dad is from, also where Gutenberg invented printing. So we are very proud to humanism and enlightenment. But I'm saying, like, what made us actually facilitate the public sphere until very recently? Journalistic practice, yes, all good ethos, yeah, but also technological advancement. Like when I was in German television, a camera was 50,000 marks. Now I have, like, where is it? Here, like in my cell phone.
Everywhere.
We have all like really good, like, so that means also like another thing, like in back in the days, we had like when my dad would buy a national newspaper, he paid a lot of money for someone going down to the archives and just like, you know, putting together the information that he needed for this article. So also this is gone to a certain extent. So media is not the public sphere anymore as they used to be. They're not the platform anymore. And actually, when I say platform, it's always already alluding to Facebook and Twitter. They became the platforms, and media entities are now also part of their platforms. And this is a shift in society that also we have to, as media people, have to like comprehend. But also it's like a general thing that everybody has to learn in the society. And even the technology companies themselves, I mean, sure, I'm not giving them any credit, but like also like you should not be like all too critical in that sense, because they also had to learn what power they now obtained. And like Google and Facebook, they said like for a long time, oh, we are only platforms, but then they realized, yeah, we are actually more than that.
Okay, so you have Gutenberg who get the printing press, but I understand that the genius really was with Luther. Luther, in developing a German Bible in the language that Luther used, really popularized Christianity and a way of talking, and it created a shared language. Is that something that we lack today? That we all seem to speak English, or elites are globally, but do we actually share the same frameworks, the same, you know, kind of substratum to kind of comprehend the world?
I can only speak from the German context here, because that I know the best. But like, do you have this narrative now saying, oh, politicians don't care and they're up here and the normal people are down there? I don't think that's accurate. I know lots of parliamentarians, MPs from all angles of the democratic spectrum, and they are highly invested in their constituency. But what I feel in terms of what I said about indignation earlier, it's like, if you wake up in the morning and you have a job to go to and something to look forward to, you cannot understand the hermeneutical gap you cannot like cross for the people who don't. Yeah. And this is, I feel like, the disenfranchised. That's not only materialistically what happened after the crisis in America in 2008. People are very disappointed that Obama helped bailing out the banks but not the homeowners. It's this question of fairness. And that's, I think, that's something that is very difficult to comprehend. This is my last book, was on empathy. It was called Homo Empathicus, where I try to make the case for that. Empathy means not, you know, it's not only just, empathy is a mix of reason and emotion. You try to make sense of things. And I feel this is like what you, when you talk about a common language, I feel that's what's missing. Like, Europe cannot take in all refugees from Africa that want to cross the Mediterranean, but it should be trying to understand why they want to cross, so in order to make better policies for them and also for us. And if you lack empathy, like the populists, the Pegida and the AfD people, like, they run completely on resentment, and resentment is not capable of making like a good assessment. Like, one of the chairs of the so-called Alternative for Germany, this right-wing party, was now asked twice in a row in the so-called summer interviews, what is the pension, the idea of the pension reform of his party. And literally two times in a row he said, we don't have any. So the point is, like, if you are busy hating Muslims, foreigners and whatever, you have no time left to make constructive policies. And that's, I feel, what we lack.
Okay, Alex, you've been around the world, you've been visiting different countries, you've been listening to what's happening on the ground, and you've been giving talks, right? Talk to us about where you see the future of democracy heading and the liberal world order, given everything that you've picked up on your travels.
Yeah, and the alternatives to that, they label it as illiberal democracies or communitarian democracies. I feel what we need to be finding is, like, what in Latin is called the bonum commune. What are we? Why? What's the common good? What is the best for the best for the greatest number of people? And I mean, there is, like, talking America about corporate America and profits, which back in the days also helped, like, you know, tiny shareholders and whatnot. But it's not the interest that should be at the core. It's the interest of all of us, and not like the people in the sense of the communist rhetoric or a nationalistic rhetoric. It's clearly nowadays we are living so close together that it matters to you here if the Amazon is burning. And when if we then turn to the Brazilian government and they say it's none of your business, you say yes, it is. But it's like, and this is something that I picked up on my journeys, that we talk about climate change is a topic that we cannot solve in a national context. We cannot solve the refugee crisis in a national context, and that's true. But I would say, moreover, we also have to find a fair understanding how the economy should be looking like in the future. Right. And I feel that's the most pressing point.
Okay, we have less than a minute.